Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Alice Bryant will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Katie Weaver and Ashley will tell us about one Honduran migrant's story.
Aide Posadas had been waiting 8 years for her son to come home. Wilmer Gerardo Nunez left Honduras for the United States in 2010. He was 35 years old. He left his home because of gang threats. Somewhere in Mexico, Nunez disappeared. Posadas told the Associated Press, "I am between a rock and a hard place. I know nothing about my son, whether he's dead or alive." The AP found that almost 4,000 Latin American migrants have died or gone missing along the same route in the past 4 years.
Posadas and her 10 children are from the Ciudad Planeta neighborhood of San Pedro Sula, Honduras. It is known as one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Posada's son left home for the United States for the first time in the 1990s, when he was 16. Posadas had just lost her factory job. Nunez would send money back home to help. He would call her almost every day. Nunez was deported 2 times, but returned to the United States each time. In 2007, he had a child with a Mexican woman, Maria Esther Lozano. When Lozano was about to give birth to another child, in July 2010, Nunez was deported for a third time. Posadas was happy to have her son back home.
But the family's neighborhood had grown more dangerous over the years. Organized crime moved in. Posadas said things were so bad that Nunez almost never went outside the house. He told his mom that he was afraid and that he wanted to go back to California to meet his new daughter. After just a few days in San Pedro Sula, and after a possible threat from gang members, Nunez left earlier than he planned.
In the past, Nunez had crossed into the U.S. at the border in California. But this time, he had an injured foot. He planned to cross at the border in Texas. The route is shorter, but also more dangerous. He let Lozano know about his plan. He called her on the phone almost every day, using the phone of the smuggler taking the migrant group across the border. About a week after leaving home, Nunez spoke with his mother for the last time. He asked her to pray that everything would turn out well. A day later, he called Lozano. He seemed calm and happy. The group made it to Piedras Negras, across from the Texas town of Eagle Pass. Lozano was told to wait for a phone call. Then she could pay the smuggler half the money, about $3,000. Then she needed to wait for another call from Nunez's sister to confirm his safe arrival before paying the remaining $3,000. The calls never came. Lozano never heard from Nunez. The smuggler told her they were still waiting to cross. Then the phone went unanswered.
Another week went by. Then Posadas saw on television news that authorities had found the bodies of 72 migrants on a large farm in San Fernando, Mexico, across the border from Texas. An investigation found that drug gang members had stopped two large trucks filled with migrants in northern Mexico. The migrants were taken to the farm and asked to join the gang. Only one of the migrants agreed. The rest were blindfolded, tied up, and shot dead. Among the identified victims were two neighbors who had left with Nunez. But there was no sign of Nunez. Nunez's father offered his genetic material to be compared with the unidentified bodies. But still, Nunez was not found. Posadas and Lozano began looking for Nunez in prisons, holding centers, and hospitals. They contacted Mexican, Honduran, and Ecuadorian authorities many times. Yet they still found nothing. After years of searching, Posadas thought that she would never find an answer to what happened to her son.
The official report on the mass killing on the San Fernando farm stated that body number 63 was a male with body art, including a tattoo of Nunez's son's name. The report also noted the body was found with a Honduran driver's license with the name Wilmer Gerardo Nunez Posadas on it. I'm Katie Weaver.
Have you ever been to an airport or train station where the official language was English? What was your experience? Easy, difficult, or in between? Today, we will explore some common phrasal verbs that can be useful as you travel to or through English-speaking places. A phrasal verb is made of two or more words, a verb plus a preposition or adverb or both. Together, the words get a new meaning. For example, the phrasal verb get in means to arrive at a place. Listen to two friends talk about a recent trip. There are six travel-related phrasal verbs. Try to find them and think about their meanings.
Hey, how was your trip?
Well, it was great, but getting there was a pain. The airport was so crowded because of flight delays. We tried to check in at a kiosk, but the machines were down. So we stood in line for 45 minutes just to pick up the tickets.
Oh, no.
Then our flight had a 2-hour delay. The plane finally took off at 9.
What time did you get in?
Around 4. Our driver picked us up on time and was super sweet. He dropped us off at the hotel, and we checked in without any trouble. The rest of the trip was wonderful.
That's great. I'm looking forward to my next big trip.
Did you find all 6 of the verbs? Before we look at each, here are some good things to know. Phrasal verbs in English are either transitive or intransitive. A transitive verb needs a direct object to express a complete thought. A direct object is a person or thing that receives the action of the verb. For example, the sentence, "I brought my suitcase," is transitive. The words "I brought" do not make a complete thought without the direct object, my suitcase. An intransitive verb does not need a direct object to express a complete thought. For example, I can say the plane landed and it makes perfect sense. Phrasal verbs can be separable or inseparable. But what does that mean? If a phrasal verb is separable, the direct object may appear in the middle of the verb. If it's inseparable, the direct object must come after. I'll show you what that means today. Transitive or not, separable or not, it sounds complex, but it's very simple, as you'll see and hear shortly. Our first verb is check in. Like many phrasal verbs, check in has more than one meaning. The one we are exploring today is intransitive. It gets no direct object. Listen again to how it was used.
We tried to check in at a kiosk, but the machines were down.
The speaker also used it about the hotel.
And we checked in without any trouble.
To check in means to report to someone when you arrive at a place to let them know you are there. When we check in at a kiosk, the machine gives us a plane ticket. When we check in at a hotel, someone gives us a room key. A verb with very close meaning and usage is check into. We use it for hotels, hostels, Airbnbs, and the like. The difference is that check into must have a direct object, but it's inseparable. Have a listen.
We checked into the hotel without any trouble.
The direct object is the hotel. Next, you heard the verb pick up. It is transitive and separable. We used two of its meanings today. Here's the first.
So we stood in line for 45 minutes just to pick up the tickets.
It means to go somewhere to get something. Note that the direct object, the tickets, comes after the verb. But because it's separable, we can also put the object in the middle, like this.
So we stood in line for 45 minutes just to pick the tickets up.
You also heard the speaker say,
our driver picked us up on time and was super sweet.
This meaning of pick up is to let or put people or things into a car, bus, ship, or something else. Note the wording pick us up. The pronoun direct object, us, is in the middle of the verb pick up. When a phrasal verb is separable, pronoun direct objects go in the middle. Okay, on to our next verb, take off. It's a verb with many meanings, but today's meaning is easy. It is intransitive and means to begin to fly. Here's how the speaker used it.
The plane finally took off at 9.
Next is the verb get in, another intransitive verb. Let's hear how it was used.
What time did you get in?
Around 4.
You may remember that get in means to arrive at a place. And finally, we have look forward to. This verb is made of 3 words. It is transitive and inseparable. Here's how you heard it used.
That's great. I'm looking forward to my next big trip.
To look forward to something means to expect it with pleasure. The direct object is my next big trip. Join us next week for part 2, Useful Travel Words and Phrases. We're looking forward to it. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as the revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the Capitol was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the Capitol must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.